Dear all, this is the lecture number 3 of the capstone, Product and Brand Management. I realized that the slide deck is quite extensive, so the short podcast will be split into two, as has happened previously in few cases. So our first sub-chapter is all about distribution management and retail management. Starting from slide 2, we have a short crash course on understanding the key elements of managing distribution. On slide number 3, I think we are highlighting the most important point. Sometimes the distribution can be a major source of competitive advantage. Oftentimes, it serves as a buffer also in situations where a rival is introducing a superior product. Let's take a very, very familiar example of Nokia. After experiencing some crisis in its supply chain management and distribution in its early heydays, Nokia learned it in the hard way, and they built a distribution powerhouse that actually served as a fortress for them, even at times when the rival companies had already introduced many of the Dutch green phones and design-wise more attractive models. People were dreaming about buying maybe something different, but then after entering the store, they realized that they are leaving the store again with a Nokia phone, because Nokia's newest models were available and always present, and the rival models were not available. So sometimes actually your distribution can also be a strength that makes you a little bit blindsided by the fact that the competition is really already catching up. On slide number 4, you know, like, we need to understand that the distribution decisions are oftentimes complex and there are lots of tensions involved. We need to always make trade-offs. If we are leaving some partners out and going for different channels, there might be some repercussions. So, and oftentimes when you look at the whole value grid, the value network, you realize that there are many conflicting interests. What is good for us might not be good to our distributors, and we need to make many trade-offs. And also distribution systems are typically very difficult to change. The high switching cost, the transaction cost is oftentimes very high. On slide number 5, we are looking at some of the specifics of distribution. Actually, interestingly, oftentimes when you look at this data set from McKinsey Research, we can see that actually the demand volatility per week and the volume per year, in a way, like, are L-shaped. We have a number of products where you have very, very high volume demand and very low volatility. Oftentimes less than 10% of the stock keeping units, but more than 50% of the profits. That is the box towards the top left hand corner of the graph. Then we have the low volume, low volatility stock keeping units. Roughly 1/4 of the demand is coming from there, 1/4 of the stock keeping units and 1/4 of the profits. That's the bottom left hand corner. Then we have the interesting corner, the top right hand corner, where we have high volume but high volatility. Oftentimes seasonal products that are coming and going, you know, like it depends on many factors also in discussions and what becomes topical in media. Oftentimes only 22% of the stock keeping units, but as much as 10% of the profits. So these are definitely the low hanging fruits in terms of profit making if you only make the right bets and choices. Then we have the long tail. Oftentimes low volume in terms of sales and high volatility. Sometimes more than 60% of the stock keeping units and only 10% of the profits. Obviously, this is where we need a digital business model in order to make it viable. And this is actually very, very much, for example, Amazon in its original form, focusing on books and contents, was focused on. Low volume, high volatility, pretty random demand, very high number of articles being sold, and the digital platforms are oftentimes the only way to make this viable as a business model. The high street model, where you have physical outlets and stores, must focus on the high volume, low volatility products, because that is the only way to make it feasible to have physical stocks and warehouses in place on site. On slide number 6, we are looking at different channel system choices. How do we distribute our products? I think in a way, like to a certain extent, even if we have very much focus on the products in this chapter, many of these ideas can be easily converted also in service businesses, where we are distributing something more intangible, sometimes even customized. So the most simple way is to have a direct channel that you own. That's the only place where you sell. And what makes this interesting is that we can see this very much in a way like in place both at the low end and high end of the retail industry. Let's take, for example, Lidl. It owns many of its own brands. They are private labels. They are only distributing through their own outlets. Or at the luxury end of the chain, Hermès, except for the perfumes, they are only selling through their own stores and outlets they are fully controlling. So they own the channel, they control it fully, and it's direct. They have direct connection with the customers. And that's the top left-hand box. The bottom right-hand box is the indirect channel, where actually we are outsourcing in a way like the selling of our products. A typical retail store for fast-moving consumer goods, any grocery chain and so on. They are indirect channels that are not controlled by the brand itself. They are independent players. And in a way, you are buying the channel by naturally giving part of the product margin to them and also investing in many of the promotional activities. Then we have the indirect channel that is owned. If we look at the top right-hand corner, there actually you are in a way like owning your own distribution, but it might be unclear for the customers that actually you are in a way like the real owner. For example, Luxottica, the huge sunglass manufacturer, they own many of the American and European sunglass retailers that have a completely different brand. Many times the companies don't even the customers don't even know that actually the brand owners are owning also the distribution, and that can be a huge source of strength. The same applies to L'Oreal, that has been in a more limited manner investing in hair salons and barber shops and hairstyling outlets, where actually they can also get more customer information and build their customer insights for product development when they know what's really happening downstream where the customer is facing and working with their products. So in a way, having full control despite having many different players and brands might make sense for multiple reasons. It's the market share game, like for Luxottica, but it can also be needed for the customer insight development. That is the case for L'Oreal. Then we have the direct channel that we buy, where we outsource the risk. This is actually a model many, in a way, like network-based distribution systems are relying on. Oftentimes it means that independent agents, freelance contractors are the representatives of your brand. In a way, it's a direct channel. The customer sees the connection immediately, but at the same time, it is in a way based on lots of autonomy. So outsourcing your direct channel, that's actually has been traditionally very common, for example, in the field of how insurance policies are being sold. In a way, independent agents are selling them for you and serving as your representatives, despite being entrepreneurs by nature. On slide number 7, we can see that there are basically three different approaches to how to organize distribution. First of all, we have the intensive distribution. In a way, this is based on an insight that the consumer, the customer, is not willing to go an extra mile in order to get your brand, but actually wants an easy access to something that is functionally enough. So in a way, if your brand is not available, he or she will go for a rival brand. So in a way, in intensive distribution case, almost all the resellers stock the product, and the price competition is oftentimes very evident. And also marketing communications is oftentimes focused on price promotions. Selective distribution is actually an intermediate choice, and that is what makes it tricky. In a way, your product needs to be or service needs to be available widely, but at the same time, it cannot be available everywhere. So where, how to hit the right spot in a way, like how to hit the right balance, is oftentimes the question. For example, Levi's, their jeans company, has been struggling in this field. They want to be premium, but they are not luxury and they need the volume. So where to distribute and where not to distribute? At one point of time, Walmart in United States was the biggest distributor for Levi's. It's pretty difficult to position yourself as a fashion brand if a supermarket chain is your most voluminous partner for distribution. So in a way, the way they manage it is that they have different product lines available at department stores, at their independent stores, and the basic lines are available almost everywhere at these middle ground market concepts and lower end department stores, but that's only the part of the range of products they have. Then finally, we have the exclusive distribution. There are only very limited number, only handpicked resellers and dealers are allowed to sell the offerings. And sometimes this is directly connected to this kind of direct channel approach where you want to own your own channels. You want to be extremely strict about how your what is the look and feel, the customer experience at the channels where your offerings are being distributed. On slide number 8, we look at the layers. Sometimes it can be very simple, like direct relationship with the company and the end customer. That's the direct channel case. But sometimes we have multiple layers, wholesalers, then we have retailers or distributors in between, and finally we get to the end customer. So indirect channels are oftentimes causing multiple layers of different actors in the your go-to-market structure and architecture and the distribution strategy. Starting from slide 9, we are looking at the vertical integration. Why does it happen? Why do brand owners want to own their channels? Sometimes the reasons are just simply based on profit and margin maximization. In a way, like not having middlemen in the value chain makes it easier for you to maximize the profit margin. Sometimes they feel that they can perform the channel functions in a more efficient manner because they know the product, they can directly go to the manufacturing, the production, the R&D and so on. Sometimes there might be economies of scale, that your size is so high that actually you don't need third parties in order to have all the benefits. And sometimes it is just about, in a way, like trying to have this kind of value proposition of the minimum price and maximum value to the end customer, which means that you cannot afford having double margins for or triple margins for each and every player. On slide 10, we start looking at something that is oftentimes very much prevalent in all the distribution systems, and that is channel conflict. There are two types of conflict: horizontal conflict, which means a conflict between parallel channels, that so you're using multiple channels. For example, you have your own distribution channel, then you have a third party channel 1, third party channel 2, and so on. Some of them have more layers than others. And in a way, like you always need some kind of overlap. It's actually a best way to guarantee that you have solid market coverage. So in a way, there must be some kind of tension in place. At the same time, if the high degree of overlap happens, it easily leads to deterioration in channel performance. So you have multiple players and no one is really selling, and it might make the whole system less viable. For example, if you have too many distributors, independent third parties, and no one is in a way like feeling that your offering is and brand is in a way bringing in lots of sales, they step by step they in a way start undermining it, and it becomes in a way like a curiosity in their portfolio. So they are not promoting it actively. It is something that you can find at the very top shelf or at the bottom shelf, but it's not in a way priority for your distributors. Or it can lead to in a way like loss of the best channel partners and distribution partners. For instance, Subway, the American fast food company, they started at one point having so many outlets, and it became problematic for even the best of them to stay profitable and make a feasible market, because in a way all of them were independent entrepreneurs, but having another outlet only one block away in a way was in a way making it very difficult for them to make a feasible profit in the marketplace. This is all about the horizontal conflict. Then the second type of conflict on slide 11 is the vertical conflict, where actually it's more associated with the breakdown into relationships between the supplier and the channel, middlemen and the channel partners. Oftentimes it means that something is going wrong in the way the channel members are in a way like feeling about the deal. Is it good for them? Oftentimes where the vertical channel conflicts happen is that the supplier, the brand owner, starts direct sales or in a way like partners with new channels, and especially gives it some kind of a priority. Let's say that it gives new offerings only to the new channel. Or the channel changes, where actually new formats of doing business are actually in a way like becoming more popular, let's say buying online or through networks, the social shopping and so on. Or that resellers, the distributors, merge or consolidate, so that in a way like suddenly it's not the brand owner anymore who has more power, but actually the pricing and many of the parameters are being dictated by actually the distributors. This is something we can actually in a way see in many European countries if we look at the food and beverage and fast-moving consumer goods. That fast-moving consumer goods and grocery chains are so powerful that there are only a number of them in one country, that they can actually use lots of power in regard to the brand owners, even the most powerful international brand owners. On slide 13, in a way like there is the third source of conflict. Sometimes the customer's buying behavior changes. In a way like customers start looking at different things, they want more information, they are more environmentally aware, or they want to have different logistics. They are not anymore comfortable in for example, carrying the heavy products by themselves, they want them delivered to their homes. Or the customer's preference going for the digital channels, not only in the field of consumers, but also in the field of business-to-business, because oftentimes, if it's something that you buy on a regular basis, it might be easier to have your transactions happening automatically, or at least through digital channels. Sometimes economic downturns can cause changes in customers' preferences, so that the customers start becoming more price sensitive, and they actually start in a way going for lower end channels. So in a way suddenly the premium channels are in a way like experiencing a loss in terms of customer flow and the spending. Now moving to a slightly different topic that might be actually in a way like more relevant in the world of business to business industries. And on starting from slide 14, we are looking at the how to how to decide on the size and the nature and the quality of the sales force. Basically, there are oftentimes two types of sales representatives. Some of them are specialists that focus on a subset of the customers, certain industries only, for example, subset of offerings, products, or certain types of deal making. They are really in-depth in what they do, but they have relatively little knowledge of the other categories or the other segments. So, in a way, oftentimes they are really good at connecting with the customers, but it might be difficult for them to go beyond their comfort zone. Then the second type is generalists. The sales representatives carry the entire offering line. In a way, oftentimes they are geographically more focused, they have smaller territories, they don't need to spend time on traveling in order to meet, you know, like a very, very niche customers from certain industry, for example. And they oftentimes spend lots of time with customers, and on average, oftentimes the cost per sales activity, call, meeting, any kind of dialogue is lower. But also oftentimes when meeting customers with very specialized and specific needs, they don't have enough knowledge. And sometimes, in a way, like the customers may feel, especially if the deal size is high and the importance of the decision is very, very high, that they don't get enough service from these generalists. There is no one way to do it right or wrong. Every company, every organization makes its own decisions and solutions. And oftentimes what we see is that Salesforce is actually in a way like it's in a way like a hybrid model, that you have a number of specialists and then you have a certain high number of generalists, and they have to collaborate, which can sometimes be a source of conflict. Moving to number 16 slide. When looking at the Salesforce performance, we need to look at two parameters. First, we have efficiency. How easy it is to segment the customers. How easy it is to, in a way, like foresee how each and every one of them should be served. And how to organize the sales force by industry, by geography, combination of these two, the size of the customer, in a way like that certain people are serving the small customers, some of them are focused on the large customers, and somewhere in between you have the medium-sized customers. So how to allocate your resources in the best possible manner, how to build a reporting line. So structuring and allocating are decisions that have lots to do with the efficiency. And how to size the sales force. In a way, how many people do you need in your sales force? A little bit further, we will discuss the idea of the sales in a way like the response function that helps us oftentimes to understand that how much is enough, how much is too little, how much is too much. But then we have the second dimension, the effectiveness. How to compensate the sales force. How many fixed and variable incentives they need, in a way. High fixed salaries, they might help to build commitment and keep the best people in-house. At the same time, high emphasis on variable incentives make them more hungry and more competition-orientated. How to hit the right balance between different types of compensation models. And again, oftentimes it's not black and white, but it's a hybrid solution. How to set the sales quotas, how much sales can be expected per person, how much the quotas do vary between regions, industries, locations, customer segments. What is a sign of good performance in a certain particular, in a way like field of responsibility. And how to train and coach the sales force, and also how to evaluate the sales force performance, how to do the performance appraisals. So how to manage both efficiency and effectiveness. On slide number 17, we're looking at the, in a way, the shifts in the field of sales management. first of all, in a way, like, I think nowadays the focus is more on retaining and growing existing accounts, and trying to, in a way, like, make them grow instead of, like, hunting for new deals. Also, from instead of focusing on transactions, it's more about becoming the preferred supplier. Sometimes we speak about partnerships and consider ourselves as an important partner for the client, when the reality is that we are the second or third or fourth best alternative from their perspective. So how to make sure that your share of the wallet and also your value you deliver is as high as possible. And instead of focusing on the price cuts and promotions and discounts, it should be more about pricing for profits, how to learn how to sell value, in a way helping the customers to see the value of your offering and pricing it accordingly. Sometimes it can be in a way of this kind of value share approach, where actually the more you deliver, the more you in a way like are entitled to get your own premiums. And understanding that how, in a way, that the service can be also an independent offering. So in a way, like, that service not for free, and that is not something that you, in a way, like, give to the customers for free in order to get the sales of the offer, the products. But actually, that services can be an independent business model, and understanding how the overall profitability of each and every customer happens. And then the fifth point is all about how to manage the customers in a meaningful and profitable manner. So that how to segment them in a way where actually you can give high levels of service that are matching the customer's needs, but you don't deliver over service, or you don't incur extra costs for providing services, for example, or managing the customers in a way they don't need, they don't expect, and they don't appreciate. Sometimes you have these high-touch customers that are very eager to pay the extra price for the advice and service, and then you have these transactional customers who just simply want to have their business in a very transactional manner, in and out, the faster and cheaper, the better. And instead of selling to anyone, finally, more and more companies are deciding to focus on their highest profit accounts, the most profitable clients and customers, and in a way trying to maximize their relationship and the share of wallet and the loyalty amongst them. On slide 18, we have, in a way, an interesting this kind of like visualization of data from one of the McKinsey research studies from 2009-2010. In a way, like, if you ask the customers, especially and these are the business-to-business customers, the senior executives and decision makers from large companies, in a way, what irritates them? 35% of the respondents said, as a number one source of irritation, that there was too much contact through all kinds of channels, in person, by phone, or by email, from the salesperson. So in a way, like, it was too much contact. 20% said that the top reason was that they didn't know really their offerings, they were too generalists, and they didn't know how the marketplace worked, how the rival and competing offerings were. So in a way, like, they weren't really specialists enough in order to have a meaningful discussion. And about 9% of them said that the sales representatives lacked the business or industry knowledge, and in a way, like, couldn't in a way really link to the customer's true business. So I think at least these three are key symptoms of bad selling and sales management that must be kept in mind. 8% said that sales style is too aggressive. That links directly to the number one reason, having too much contact. And about 8% in a way, said that, in a way, like, that the service levels were very good before the contract was signed, but when the deal was closed, you know, like, the communication stopped immediately, and the customer felt being ignored. On slide 19, we are looking at the sales response function. In a way, like, we oftentimes assume that the more salespeople means more cost, but also more sales. But it's not as linear. So in a way, like, how do we, in a way, like, understand the diminishing marginal returns that can be expected? So if we go directly to the slide 20, in a way, like, oftentimes when we, in a way, like, increase the sales sales force size and marketing expenditure a little bit, in a way, it immediately drastically increases the sales, and in a way, the return on additional investment and sales force is very high, and then it keeps on growing at a steady rate to a certain point. You know, like, at sometimes you need to have a certain coverage in order to maximize the sales and the profitability. But then after you have covered the marketplace well enough, the sales response curve, in a way, like, start changing. The additional sales you get by increasing the size of the sales force and the marketing expenditure is not anymore that high. Actually, the average sales per sales representative starts going down. And in a way, like, your additional marketing spending doesn't anymore, in a way, cause increase in the sales volume or profitability. So in a way, the market gets saturated. You have covered it well, and already too well, in a way. Like, there's overlap, there are inefficiencies, and so on. For each and every company in each and every industry, the sales response function is slightly different. So in a way, oftentimes we just need to look at the benchmarks from the industry, from parallel industries, in order to understand what is the best model for us. And you also need to keep on watching how the revenue and the profit and the marketing expenditure, the cost of the sales representatives, the cost of marketing communications and promotions, how do they correlate? Oftentimes you find the best balance only through experimentation. This is the end of the first part of the lecture number 3. Thank you so much.